Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to new and returning listeners. I'm Dr. Danica Ramsey-Brimberg and your host of this episode of New Books in Irish Studies under New Books Network. I'm excited to welcome Dr. John Gillis, author of the recently published The Fat and More Psalter, The Discovery and Conservation of a Medieval Treasure. Welcome, John, to the podcast.
Thank you, Danica. Nice to be here.
Would you tell us a little about yourself?
Well, I am a manuscript conservator. I have worked for nearly 35 years now in the conservation department in the library of Trinity College Dublin. Many of your listeners might be familiar with Trinity College Dublin as the home of the famous Book of Kells. Of course, that's not what we're here to talk about today, but yes. So I've been involved in this sort of manuscript conservation work and conservation work in general as a book conservator, as I say, for over 35 years.
And then for those listeners unfamiliar with your book, what is the Fat and More Psalter about?
The Fat and More Psalter is an early medieval manuscript, and it basically contains it did contain the 150 Psalms when it was first produced in Latin, which was, of course, part of the Old Testament. And it is a book produced on parchment, which is typical of the time, this period we're talking about in the early medieval period, 8th and 9th century. And it was discovered in a bog in the Midlands of Ireland back in 2006.
And then how did you get involved with the project regarding the book?
That's a good question, actually. Yeah. So I was happily working away in Trinity College, and I was very much like any other observer. It made headline news of the day. It made the front pages of many of the national papers, and I was reading it as excitingly as anybody else that discovered it. It was brought, once it was retrieved from the bog, it was brought to the National Museum of Ireland's conservation department, because all discovered treasures in Ireland of any description immediately become property of the state. Unlike some other countries where there's kind of an ownership and fee paid. So the state immediately takes ownership of it. And in this case, National Museum took it back to their department. When it was established what they were actually looking at, because of the poor state of it, of course, it took a little while to work it all out. And they knew they were dealing with an unusual set of organic materials, if you like. So if we think about what an early medieval book is made of, and we're talking about leather, but most particularly, as I said earlier, we were talking about parchment. Now, the conservation department in the National Museum is housed for all the artifacts that come through there, organic, inorganic, and they have a team of highly trained professionals. But parchments and books wouldn't be typical for their area of expertise. So they asked, would I be interested in looking at it at first, at the first stage? And then on the back of that, I went on secondment from Trinity. Initially, the idea was I would be there for 2 years while we kind of worked it all out. It ended up being actually 4.5 years.
And then As a part of your involvement in the book, you mentioned that you're specifically in the acknowledgement section that this book was based on your PhD thesis. How did you transform your thesis into this book?
With great difficulty, I would say, in the first instance. Really what drove me or what kind of motivated me to do this, to take it from the conservation project into a thesis, was the idea of finding a way to expand it out into other discipline areas. Because, as I say, my job, if you like, while I was up in the museum, was to focus on the conservation, the stabilization of the manuscript, to make it accessible and to allow it to be displayed, in fact, of course, as a national object, as a national treasure. But it was just so obvious right from the off that there was so many elements of this that needed investigation, that needed time spent on it. And I thought, well, if I'm going to invest so much time into it, I may as well try and get something out of it. I say that slightly flippantly, but of course the other thing was it put structure on. So I approached Trinity and asked if they'd be willing to support me, which thankfully they did, to convert it into a PhD thesis, which took all of 7 years to complete.
And then with the book, it's organized by studying various parts of your analysis. So after the introduction, you have chapters on conservation, the vellum text block, the writing and decoration, the binding, the trial motifs on the cover, and early medieval book decoration in general, the monastic landscape overall, the find spot, and finally the conclusion along with the bibliography and appendices. Why did you organize your book in this way?
Well, again, it kind of harps back to my original point that I really wanted to demonstrate that a medieval manuscript such as the Fadhamore Psalter has so much more to inform us beyond its contents, if you like. You know, as a three-dimensional organic object, there's so much it's telling us if you're willing to extract much more than the words and the letters on the pages. How it's made, the materials used, the evidence of damage that occurred to it. And because it has this multidisciplinary aspect to it, I thought the easiest way to work it and you know, taking into account kind of my methodical way of looking at things in general, was to break it down into these blocks of individual segments of information, if you like. You know, so although they link to each other, you know, the art history links to the paleography, but nevertheless, you can read them as separate pieces and glean particular information out of the separate parts.
And then one of the things I enjoyed reading was all of the amazing things you were actually able to pull out of studying the manuscript. But at the same time, there were a lot of challenges with working with such a manuscript. What were some of the difficulties, or also at the same time advantages, of the Psalter actually being placed in the bog where it was found?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, certainly it was an unknown entity really right from the word go, because when I tried to do research into the conservation aspect. So if I give a little bit of context here, the manuscript was buried beneath the ground for over 1,000 years. The climate, the environment, if you like, in a bog is very different than you would find, say, it was buried in earth. It's a fluid environment. It's a wet, damp, and acidic environment. So it's a very aggressive and generally speaking, detrimental to organics that are buried there. Because of that, the manuscript itself was in a very poor state of repair when it was retrieved. That led to a number of challenges. Was how do we stabilize this very fragile, very fragmented, with much losses to it? How do we stabilize this and make it accessible, as I say, for display, for scholars to study? How do we do this? And I say this in lectures sometimes, that if you Google bog and vellum or parchment, you don't get very much back. This was new territory. So we had to start from scratch, and it took some months to come up with a method to extract this moisture, this saturated moisture that had been, you know, as I said, the book has sat in for over 1,000 years to stabilize it. I mean, without getting into the kind of technical side of it too much, parchment is unlike leather. Parchment is produced under this high level of tension. And when you allow it to dry, which we did, we sampled a little piece by itself and just allowed it to air dry, and it reduced in size by about 75%. It's extremely hygroscopic. So you can imagine if we just decided to dry out this sodden book, we would be left with nothing but a big clump of solid parchment. In fact, it would actually be a lump of gelatin, if you like, more or less, because that's the kind of stage it goes through. It goes through this gelatinization. So finding a way to stabilize and dry the sodden parchment fragments, which are very fragile, broken, what was one of the kind of most stressful challenges and one of the most difficult challenges. But we succeeded, and that's why I'm sitting here today talking to you, because we have something to talk about. We managed to use a method of what we call solvent exchange. We swapped out the water for a non-polar solvent, and then we dried through a vacuum. And although it took nearly 2 years to dry the whole manuscript, which is only 60 folios, but that's the kind of length of the process. So that was kind of one of the difficulties, one of the many difficulties that challenges it presented. But as you did ask also about advantages, and probably the biggest advantage the manuscript at least had from being buried for 1,000 years is that we didn't get at it. Us people, you know, in use over centuries. If we think of all the early medieval manuscripts or later medieval manuscripts, the revered ones, you know, the highly illuminated, as I said, I mentioned Book of Kells, Book of Durrow, Lindisfarne, Gospels, all these wonderful gospel books. In many of these, we have to look for trace evidence of what they originally looked like. What were the original sewings? What were the original bindings looked like? Because over the centuries, they've been rebound time and time again. They've been trimmed. There have been large losses of areas of text. There have been pages lost and removed from it. So because we know the Fadenmore Psalter actually was placed in the ground quite early on after it was produced, we know this from the strata and the location it was found in, then we know, although the poor thing was bashed up and disheveled and sodden and degraded, it was in its original state. It was, you know, unmodified, if you like. So that was a big advantage, because that's information that's hard to come by, particularly from a codicological point of view. That is studying the form of a book, what makes up the materiality of a book.
So thinking about that materiality, as well as your experience with more generally with conservation and the Fadenmore Psalter, how are books artifacts?
Exactly for that reason, because they are three-dimensional objects made up of a number of components. So the components themselves tell us, are part of the artifact, and we look at the components. Let me say, for example, a book is sewn on a support across the spine. The materials they choose to use for that support inform us about the geography, where it might have been produced, the chronology, when it might have been produced, and the availability of materials. The leather they cover the boards with, if there are boards in play, tell us the availability of what sort of animal stock was around. The style used tells us what influences came into play. What did the bookbinder or the scribe or the artist know? What was their knowledge base when they were producing the manuscript? So we know the influences from outside. So this is why I say, you know, if we think of it as, and I always say this about, they are these three-dimensional objects that have much more to say than their contents. If you take the time to look at them, it's all a bit kind of CSI, but you know, the information is there.
So with this particular book, who would have likely owned it in early medieval Ireland, and how would the manuscripts have been perceived and used by them?
Good question. We can make presumptions, and obviously we can't know for sure. Well, we can't. Sometimes we do know for sure if there's a colophon, if the scribe has been good enough to sign it for us, and he's important enough to show up in historic documents, then, you know, we do have the odd manuscripts, which is the MacGregor Gospels, that attest to this. But in general terms, we have to base it on supposition and on what we know was typical practice of the time. If we look at the area where the Fatimore Psalter was found, which is what they called the monastic midlands, bang in the middle of what we call the monastic midlands of Ireland. This was an area that was heavily populated with small and larger monasteries. So we can take a leap, and it's not too much of a gamble, I guess, to say it was likely the product of a local monastery. Its use is the complicated one for the Fatimore Psalter in particular. I could say, wait, you should read the book and find out, but I'll give you some clues that there are certain features on the book that suggest it may have had more than just a personal devotional book, let's say, of a monk. There are markings on the cover to suggest it was the cover itself was being used as a way of testing out what we call trial motifs, testing out artistic designs. The way the book was constructed, which looks like it wasn't actually a single, it may or may not have been a single block of pages. It may have been individual gatherings. And if it had a didactic purpose, if it was being used for teaching young novices, then having a book that you can give out in sections for the trainees to either learn their Latin from. Don't forget, Irish monks have to learn their Latin. It isn't the vernacular language here. Or learn their letters and writing, then it may be a useful way of doing it. So I would say we're quite sure it was the product of a monastery. Its function was not really sure about that, but it's quite possible that it was used as a teaching tool, if you like.
With this particular aspect of its history in mind, can you walk me through, probably, I guess, very as brief possible? I don't want to give away details from the book, but can you walk me through the life of this particular manuscript?
Well, you know, it's supposition. I haven't got the crystal ball to look into here. It's supposition to some degree, but so the cover of the manuscript is interesting in itself, and we'll probably talk about that a little more in detail later. But the cover of the manuscript displays what we would call historic wear and tear. So there's, and this goes back to the artifact aspect of it again. So just looking at it tells us it had a tough enough life. It's got tears in areas from use. You can actually see wonderful erosion of the pigment layer where it was held. And people, you know, in early medieval Ireland held books just like people in modern Ireland held the book. So you find the wear in specific areas. So the cover suggests to us that it was well used, well worn, in fact, and multi-purposed. So as I mentioned earlier, there's these very, very fine scribings of people testing decorations, Irish, very much kind of this Irish style of decoration that you would find in the medieval manuscripts, this lace work and knot work and key patterns, all inscribed into the cover. So there's an additional use, if you like, for the cover. For the text block itself, for the Book of Psalms themselves, I should say at this point that actually we've only got 15%. We have something of every page. We have something of all 60 folios, but there are large losses in most of the folio. So we're not looking at a complete volume from that point of view. What we can see and what we might comment on is that the text itself has very little in the way of its evidence of wear and tear, its evidence of use. So there are no glosses no interlinear glosses. There's no margin notes, which is very, very typical you see of a manuscript that works its way through the centuries. People add to it, people make observations, people doodle on it, you know. So there's very little evidence of that. So that all suggests that although the cover may have had a hard use and may have had a previous life, the manuscript itself was fairly, let's call it fresh, when it was actually found its way into the bar.
And then with the creation of this manuscript, this is just one phase. While the manuscript's being made, were there different people involved in the process of constructing it? And if so, how do you differentiate between individuals' work, or can you differentiate between their work?
Good. It's a good point. Again, there are the odd manuscripts that are generous enough to inform us of this. The Lindisfarne Gospels famously talk about both the scribe and the metalwork person in the binding. In more general terms, what you can say is in this period, and I'll reference Ireland particularly in this instance, in this period, the production of a book in a monastery was an in-house operation from start to finish, even most likely from the point of view of the animals used to provide the leather and the parchments were probably out of their own stock. So it was an in-house process. And like you would expect, I guess, you know, there would have been specialists who would have been specialists in making the leather. There might have been the same specialist who prepared the parchment. Then, of course, you have the scribe and you have the artist. But very often you will have more than one scribe within a manuscript. In fact, it's more than likely you'll have more than one scribe involved. It's more unusual to have a single scribe. The paleographers will determine that by looking for changes. It's not my area of expertise at all, but they will note differences in the hands. They often explain them to me. I can't see them. So it's a fine art where they can see changes in the writing style, and it can be very, very subtle because, of course, all these scribes are trained, unlike today, where you're not trained in how to write specifically. They were trained in a very specific way, in a very specific manner, to use a very specific style. And in the case of the Fatimore Psalters, it's a hand we call insular majuscule. So every letter was supposed to be formed in a particular way. But subtleties and of course just human, you know, differences mean different scribes have different, and that's how we determine a change in hands.
And then were you able to, granted, I know the fragmented nature of the Fatimore Psalter, but were you able to determine any different people being involved perhaps in the creation of the manuscript?
Well, not really, to be honest. I mean, all we know is there was a scribe and other people certainly had access to it, as I say, referencing back again to this kind of doodling on the front cover. I can't imagine the scribe themselves, you know, if it's their precious manuscript, then, you know, you imagine it at home with your favorite hardback book that you've bought. You can't imagine yourself scribbling on the front of it, can you? You know, so certainly other people seem to have got involved, or perhaps a manuscript falls out of use or function, because of course all these manuscripts at this stage were being copied from an exemplar. That's what they're doing; they're producing copies of a known text. So it's really it's nigh on impossible to say how many people are involved with it. But you know, as a kind of conservative estimate, you would imagine there was at least a scribe and at least a craftsperson of some description to produce the substrate for them to write on.
And then thinking of these designs as well as the text and the construction of the manuscript, one of the most interesting aspects of the manuscript among many within your book is the fact that different cultures were drawn upon both within Ireland as well as outside of it. Could you please elaborate more on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is where Fatimore became, it added an additional kind of thread of interest, if you like. It's an element that we weren't expecting. So when the let's go back to 2006 again a little bit here, and when the manuscript was discovered, and when news of this broke, and when it was discussed with scholars, they all went, "Oh, we knew it would be a Psalter." You know, if they were going to find a book in a bog, don't forget it is the first ever book, medieval manuscript retrieved from a wetland environment in Europe, don't mind Ireland. But they all went, "Oh, yeah, we knew it would be a Psalter," because the Psalter played such a central role in monastic Ireland from a teaching point of view. As I say, don't forget the Irish monks didn't have Latin, it wasn't a language. So not only when they were taking on Christianity on board, they also had to take on the language of Christianity, which was, of course, Latin, and the written word was in Latin. So you had that aspect to it. So I'm losing the thread. What were you asking me?
Were different cultures involved in, did different cultures inspire the people that were working on the manuscript?
So this was the aspect. And again, it goes back to a point I made earlier about the idea that it was untouched by us. It had survived in its original condition, albeit now a very poor condition. So it had avoided all modifications through the centuries. And what that condition and what that structure told us was that the influence was from a Roman Greco-Christian influence, a Mediterranean influence from the Near East, where in fact the codex was developed, the folded book as we know it today, that developed. And that had a particular style to it and a particular way of manufacturing it. And many aspects of the structure of the Padmore Psalter are contained in this. So, you know, we're talking across continents here, in fact. And yes, there are elements and influences. It's not a huge surprise, let's say, you know. I mean, I do think we always underestimate the ability of the medieval humanity to travel, to move around, to transport goods, to trade. So they were exposed to these things, but it's nice to have physical evidence of it. And the Padmore Psalter in its structure shows direct influences from that Mediterranean early Christian culture.
In light of that, would you also talk about a bit more about the Hiberno-Coptic links that are expressed within the book?
Yes. Well, that's kind of honing in, if you like, a little bit more on what I just commented on that. So when the book was discovered, the cover, we could see the writing. And as I mentioned earlier, we could see this very Irish hand, this insular majuscule hand. And everyone, yep, that's definitely an Irish book, no doubt about that. But the cover lay on the bottom of this mass of bog material, of weeds, of roots, and of course, of fragments of manuscript. And it took me a long time to get to it because I literally worked through the strata until we got to the bottom. But it was kind of peeking out enough. And indeed, before the process, conservation process even began, scholars were brought over and they were kind of also intrigued by what this original cover. That's how rare original covers are, that it created this sort of interest, you know. And they all drew kind of parallels with Coptic book structures. To describe very briefly of what they were talking about and what we would discover is, if we imagine a binding, a book binding, and it has two boards and it's covered with a material, typically leather. With these early Coptic Mediterranean structures, it was a single piece of leather, just creased, like a folder, like your modern day wallet that you carry around documents in, these plastic wallets, similar to that, if you like, complete with flap and all. So this was the parallel they were drawing to, that it had this specifically Coptic look to it, because that's what it appeared like at the bottom of the ground. And indeed, when we eventually got to it, yes, indeed, it does. It mirrors not only does it mirror stylistically and technically, it actually mirrors in the materials used, because the lining typically of these Coptic style covers were the leather was lined with papyrus, which of course was plentiful in Coptic Egypt. The Padmore Psalter cover is also lined with papyrus, which I can tell you raised quite a few eyebrows, you know, wondering how papyrus managed to make its way all the way over here.
And then is this in light of these connections further across the seas, how did the Fatimore's Psalter then compare with other psalters and more generally to the corpus of known manuscripts from early medieval Ireland? Is it I guess you can't necessarily say is a typical example, but is it somewhat of a typical example of the period?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's safe enough to say it. In many ways, it's typical, and in other ways, it's untypical. So it is very typical from the point of view of how it's laid out. It's, as again, we'll go back to the idea, the text itself, the writing is Irish minuscule. It's exactly what you would expect for a major manuscript. It's the largest kind of A4 size, you know. It's single column. Again, a kind of Irish feature. It's the Psalms, and the Psalms were traditionally here, not exclusively in Ireland, but you know, nearly in every example of Irish psalters we have, medieval psalters, divided into 350s. This was to aid the learning process rather than kind of bombarding you with 150. So they would break them up into 350s, and they would usually mark the beginning of each 50 with some illumination or decorated lettering. The Fatimore also has this feature. So and I'll say another thing, it is written on calfskin vellum, and I've been exposed to the majority of early medieval Irish manuscripts in one way or another over the years, and can state categorically that for whatever reason, every one of them are also on vellum. So it seems to be a tradition that we use calfskin vellum for our manuscripts. On the continent, you'll find goatskin, you'll find sheepskin, but here we seem to use vellum. So there we have a text block that is screaming at you, I'm Irish, you know. It's only missing the shamrock at the bottom of the page to let you know. However, of course, as we just mentioned, the cover is telling us otherwise. And it's got this, if you want to call it exotic, you know, Near Eastern aspect to it. Not, as I say, not only in its makeup, but also in the materials. So it's familiar and unfamiliar, both in the one book.
And then in addition to the physical structure, you actually study the content of the manuscript as well. You've brought this up earlier in the interview. One of the cornerstones of the book is the need to investigate all different aspects and involving different scholars from both the sciences and the humanities. Why was conducting multidisciplinary research critical?
It was my attempt to extract as much as we can from it. And always to do that, I think you need to engage with as many experts as you possibly can. And again, as you say, we mentioned this earlier, that as an object, as an artifact, it requires that multidisciplinary approach, because there are areas, it requires paleography, it requires experts in the writing, it requires historical scholars to understand. In fact, we actually have Psalter scholars. You know, we have, luckily, we're lucky that we have one of the kind of world-renowned Psalter scholars here in Ireland. It requires the codicologists, and that's when coming in to look at the structure, how it was made up. So, and indeed the hard sciences, you know, which we are now engaging with more, and particularly from the conservation point of view, we're engaging in the hard sciences. And all of these come together to help us understand better the background, the availability of materials, and just in general, create a fuller picture, if you like.
Can you give an example where two different subject areas overlapped while we were working on the Fatimore Psalter?
We were looking at the writing with we're lucky enough again to have here Professor Tim O'Neill, who is a calligrapher and Irish historian, and he was very much involved in the project, as I say, looking at the writing. He understands changes in hand, changes in style, but we also wanted to see if we could analyze what were they using to write with. At this period, we expect iron gall inks to be used. But in order for that, I mean, with experience, you get to be able to tell these the difference in inks and carbon inks and angle inks, but you need the science to back it up. Otherwise, you can never really be sure, and there can be combinations. So combined with Tim's work of saying, you know, what was used and how it was produced, we applied the hard sciences of XRF, X-ray fluorescence, and this reads the component parts of the pigments. And by reading the component parts of the pigments, we can determine what those inks were. And you know, that's just one example where particularly the hard sciences and the kind of scholarly side of it combine to get an end result. And the end result of that, although, you know, not necessarily getting any world breaking news, but it's confirmation, it's solid confirmation that what we're looking at is what we think it is.
And then turning to the contents of the manuscript, why were the Psalms critical at this time?
Yes. Again, it goes back to an earlier point I was making about when Christianity arrived in Ireland in the 5th century, and we slowly started to absorb it and it was accepted. It part of the Christianity, but obviously it's a religion of text, it's a religion of words, which requires books, and the language of Christianity is Latin. So not only when Christianity was taken up and accepted here and it started to develop, it moved from a diocesan aspect of Christianity quite quickly by the 6th century into a more monastic, and in fact, this is the kind of, you know, world that Father Moore was from. The kind of monastic Christianity developed here quite quickly and almost overshadowed the kind of diocesan Church of Rome. But in order to train these novice monks, the Oblates, not only did they have to learn the language, they had to learn their texts, their religious texts. And the Psalms was always seen as an ideal way of doing both. So they would learn their letters. They had to, as I say, commit to memory, which is an amazing feat. I always think all 150 Psalms. So it was very much this, although it's part of the Old Testament, of course, it was very much a didactic part of training monks to become, you know, to be able to become what they call psalters. So they were trained in their psalms.
Your book is also about as much the context of the psalter in early medieval books and manuscript production. Why was this such an essential element of your book, and to weave it throughout the throughout your book?
Why was, sorry, I did not follow that.
Sorry, why was the providing the context of the Psalter as well as early medieval manuscript production an important element of your book?
Yeah, well because it connects to the previous point that because the Psalter had such a central role here and generally, I think, through the Christian world, it played such a central role. And interestingly enough, one of our very earliest manuscripts, surviving manuscripts in Ireland, the Cathach, dates around 600, is actually also a Psalter. And we have very few of them. There must have been loads of them. There must have been lots and lots of Psalters and other, of course, gospel books, etc. But we imagine there must have been a lot of Psalters around. So, but we very little to compare of them. We've much later ones, and we have the Cathach, this really early one from 600, but we also have some from 11th, 12th century. But nothing from that, what they call the kind of high period in this early medieval period. And the Father Moore arrived, poof, bang in time, just in that perfect moment. So it had a very significant context, if you like, from the corpus of early medieval manuscripts that survive here.
And then what does then the book reveal more about the connections of early Irish monasteries and monastic sites in Ireland in general to the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, we know about the Peregrini. We know that once monasticism established itself here, very shortly after that, in the 7th century and 8th century, they they migrated outwards again. So this is kind of on the back of the Dark Ages, where you know, society had kind of broken down and religion had kind of faded. We had Ireland, who had originally got its religion from Europe, was now going back, if you like, and bringing it back and spreading it. So, and we have, of course, we have extant evidence of this throughout Europe. There are monasteries in Italy, in Bobbio, in Switzerland, in St. Gallen. And these are all Irish monastic sites that were established by Irish monks spreading out. We also, of course, have in our annals, in our historic documents, evidence of monks coming here to train from a far away, believe it or not, as Egypt, as you know. So there is, although we have no solid evidence, it is documented that we had monks from. So, and you've also got the pilgrimages, you know. So the as well as these kind of establishing monastic sites outside of Ireland, and this was seen as part of their mission, they would also travel, and so you would also, of course, get pilgrimages where you've got monks and priests coming from various different locations, and congregating. Rome would be an obvious one where they would congregate. So you get this kind of, cross-fertilization, if you like, of belief and of discussion. And in fact, we even have artifacts. We have been exchanged and evidence of that happening, you know, during these pilgrims.
So does then the Fadden Moor Psalter encapsulate early medieval Irish culture and life through these links, and as well as other aspects of it?
Yeah, I suppose it does. And in fact, it does it in a way that other manuscripts don't, that, you know, other high-end, highly illuminated manuscripts don't. And that's because it is displaying elements in its binding of something that's not typical of on our shores. We're seeing direct influence from another Christian culture on Irish culture, and its physical evidence of that. Now, there is still argument as to whether this cover of the Fadden Moor Psalter is an import, is it from one of these remote religious sites, or it's the technology learned and adopted here. Either, there are two camps, and, you know, it remains a kind of mystery. But it does demonstrate, as you say, it does demonstrate very well that Ireland wasn't this inward, insular-looking culture, that it was part of the larger Christian world at that time. And indeed, a key part of it from the point of view of expanding it and of producing the manuscripts. They were, you know, avid copiers of texts, even outside religious texts, of early Roman texts.
And then what is your favorite part of the book?
Probably the beginning of Psalm 51, Quid Gloriator. If you remember, I mentioned earlier about this dividing up the Psalms into the 350s. And in the Fadden Moor Psalter, they mark the beginning of each of the 50s by using a decorated letter. Otherwise, the Fadden Moor Psalter is quite plain, and there's very little in the way of decoration. We don't have all this wonderful illumination you see in the exotic illuminated manuscripts that survive. But the Quid Gloriator has this what would have been at one time a wonderfully ornate geometric lettering at the beginning. The quid has got this massive big Q with crosses inside it, blocks of color. So you've got this combination of insular writing, zoomorphic features. It's even got this wonderful little bird's head at the bottom with a kind of tail coming out the back of its head. Very strange features. So it just reminds us that, or reminds me that, it wasn't this kind of plain day to day, as was, I even suggested myself at one stage, just kind of what I called medieval paperback, but that it was a quality product, and it can be difficult to visualize it when you see it in its state today because it suffers so much. But that page, the Corriere page, shows that, and again, it comes back to a point you're making about how many people involved, that, you know, this was a skilled artist produced this wonderful page. And we actually had it reproduced because, of course, but we had this Qui Gloriata page reproduced. It's in the book, and it just gives you an idea of the vibrancy and the skill and the visual effect this manuscript would have had.
And then what is the one thing that you hope readers take away from reading your book?
Right. Well, just I guess that they appreciate what was required to produce a book like this in that period, but also what can be achieved when what appears to be very little surviving by just through hard graft, through the resources being made available to you, and having the access to the expertise you need. That, you know, as I say, what looked like, and to give you an idea, this manuscript, before its conservation treatment, before when it was taken out of the ground, quickly gained the nickname of the Lasagna, and it, just based on what it looked like. Yet we managed to you know, take it from what was basically a lump of massive organic material and convert it. And you see this happening through the book, to my book rather than the Psalter, the processes of survival and how much can actually be retrieved, how much and I mean that by information as opposed to actual material, how much information can be gleaned from what seems like a hopeless thing lost in a bog.
Do you have any future projects or anything else that you'd like to mention on the podcast?
Currently I'm turning my focus to later medieval Irish material and Irish language manuscripts, which is another area. Obviously, the written word here through all this period was in Latin, as I say, typically. The odd Greek, but mostly in Latin. But the vernacular came back into use in the kind of later centuries, from the kind of 12th century on. And there is a lot of work there. We don't have a huge survival rate, but across institutions here and indeed abroad are very important Irish language manuscripts. So at the moment, I'm kind of involved in looking at the codicology of these manuscripts, how they were put together, what their usage was, the materials used. So the same thing. So yeah, it's ongoing, never ending.
It sounds really interesting. Thank you so much, John, for joining me today to talk about your book.
Pleasure. Thank you.
To find out more about whether this was the Fadden Moor Psalter was an unintentional deposit or an accidental loss, buy Dr. John Gillis's book, The Fadden Moor Psalter, The Discovery and Conservation of a Medieval Treasure, which is available now through the Wardwell Group and the National Museum of Ireland. To see the Fadden Moor Psalter itself, you can visit the National Museum of Ireland Archaeology on Kildare Street in Dublin. If you'd like to hear more episodes, subscribe to New Books on Irish Studies on the New Books Network website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, stay safe. And keep reading.